This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. It's nice to have you listening today. It has been a roller coaster week for U.S. policy towards Syria. When the week opened, the Obama administration was engaged in a full-court press with members of Congress trying to build support for U.S. military action against the Assad regime. Now, as the week closes, Russian President Vladimir Putin has floated a plan to put Syria's chemical weapons cache under international control. And President Obama gave a televised speech in which he both defended the need for military action and also urged Congress to wait on a vote so the Russian plan could be pursued. Art Sear of Carthage College is our foreign policy contributor. He's with us now to help make sense of what's happening. Nice to have you back.
Well, thank you much.
What do you make of this latest twist to the saga of Syria, the Russian proposal to bring Syria's stock of chemical weapons under international control?
I think it's a very shrewd move. It's amazing, isn't it? I think President Putin may well be a serious contender for a Nobel Peace Prize if this initiative and momentum keeps up. He certainly should receive an Academy Award, maybe a Super Bowl ring. Given Russia's limited...
I think he already has a Super Bowl ring, right?
given Russia's, in objective terms, very limited resources. They have nuclear weapons, but they don't mean as much as they used to. They're actually a very weak economy, except for oil. Given his background as a KGB lifer and pro, bluntly a very brutal man, as well as a very smart man, it's remarkable that he's been able to leverage the current situation into effectively world leadership.
Well, is there any way we can know for certain the motivations behind this offer?
I think the motivations are self-interest. I think serious people listen to NPR. George Kennan, K-E-N-N-A-N, who had Milwaukee roots, a principal definer and planner of U.S. policy during World War II, and he was very young, and for many years afterwards. He's one of the most perceptive analysts of Russia. He was obsessed with Russia, in love with Russia, afraid of Russia and the Soviet Union. And he emphasized continuity in terms of the way Russians pre-communist have approached the world, and caution in the use of force, constant disciplined focus on self-interest because they were weaker than other European great powers has really defined Russia and the Soviet Union and now Russia again. And I think Putin's operating in line with that tradition.
There are a number of lines of analysis about this move by Putin and the Russians. One is that they would not even be taking this role if it weren't for the threat that the U.S. might unilaterally take military action. And at the same time, there's another line of analysis that goes, the Russians give the Obama administration great cover to drop their call for military action unilaterally. Can both of those things be right?
In theory, in practice, I think the latter is right. There is a palpable sense of relief in the White House and especially in the always turbulent and unpredictable hallways of Congress, both houses, that we may be off the hook on this. I don't believe the first is really plausible. The president especially has been trumpeting this, including in his address to the nation Tuesday night. But while we have been threatening military action, we've now been threatening it for a long time, which means we lost the initiative and Putin grabbed the ball. Also, the president reiterated more and more and more that this would be a very limited strike, you know, very focused, in a sense, very tactical, which means that Assad and Putin and others involved, I think, were less and less concerned over time. It not only would not, in any strategic sense, destroy their assets, but also were giving them an enormous amount of time to insulate themselves from whatever cruise missiles might be targeted at.
Vladimir Putin authored an opinion piece in the New York Times on Thursday, just another feather in his cap,
right.
Building up his portfolio in case he, you know, has to apply for journalism jobs later. He urged the U.S. to back off its threat of using military force. Could you make the argument that really the U.S. already has?
Yes, I think that's right. And again, it's permitted him to seize the initiative. Successful politicians don't, of necessity, confuse rhetoric and talk with action. We professors are often quite guilty of that for understandable reasons. We sit in our offices and decide what people should do, and then we open the door and we tell the world what it should do, and we're surprised when people don't immediately applaud. If you get to the top in politics, you've had to broker interests, you've had to reconcile interests, and you've had to get things done. President Obama has gone a remarkably long way in a very short period of time, and he's also our chief executive. I mean, no disrespect at all, but one has the sense that there is sort of the academic weakness. I've made a speech, I've gotten applause, therefore it will happen. But not much has actually happened in the past 5 years, and this is in foreign policy coming home to roost.
Well, and you could make the argument that the Obama administration was really in need of an out for this, given the amount of isolation that, you know, between Vladimir Putin's worldwide PR maneuvering,
yes,
opposition to military force by many in the American public, much of the U.S. Congress, and even our allies in Britain. There was not a lot of support this administration had, short of Senator McCain.
That's a fair point. And even McCain, Congress is like an opera. Everybody has an opinion, often expressed at great length. Even McCain had reservations and permutations and corrections and connections he wanted to put into any resolution. So, in fact, Congress ever passes anything, it's going to be a Rube Goldberg device with all kinds of impractical additions, which underscores the point again. If you're going to use military force, you should use it very quickly and as ruthlessly as possible.
There's also an interesting contradiction at work here, given the opposition by a majority of the American public to military action in,
yes,
Syria. At the same time, it's difficult to imagine if a majority of Americans would support the Russian president telling Americans what to do or think.
Oh, I think that's true. On the other hand, having mentioned George Kennan and continuity, the PR skill that the Kremlin is currently exercising does represent progress. Dictatorships, whether of the old-fashioned totalitarian variety or the traditional variety, they tend to be very heavy-handed in their public relations, partly because the guys at the top have to listen, only have to listen to themselves if they're around for a while. I think the Kremlin collectively and Putin at the top, they've developed considerable skill in the always demanding, always sophisticated U.S. media market. Whatever we are in this great country, we're not a dictatorship, and we benefit long term. They're becoming much more cosmopolitan and much more worldly at dealing with the rest of the globe. It's quite remarkable, very impressive, especially given a secret police background. This is not your typical KGB guy.
This is a KGB guy with some insight into how Twitter works.
Exactly. Or at least people around him. He's very well advised. He picks good younger people. He's a great survivor, obviously. He also operated in Eastern Europe, which is worth mentioning. John le Carré, who spent some time in British intelligence before he became someone who kind of now defines intelligence work of the skillful British variety for everybody else. His earliest and best work was focused on Central Europe, Germany, and in particular Berlin. The Russians hired a lot of ex-Nazis who weren't necessarily skillful intelligence operatives, but they were challenging colleagues. And that dynamic meant that East German intelligence turned out to be particularly brutal, particularly insightful and ruthless. The East German spy apparatus had several great coups in dealing with West Germany during the Cold War. And that's something I just thought of as we're talking, but it's extremely important to pursue further in understanding the current dynamic.
Well, and it's interesting because we are still probably a generation away from leadership in that part of the world that will not have emerged from an Eastern Bloc mentality. There will be a generation before too long that was not alive or was certainly very young when the Berlin Wall fell.
Absolutely. And that applies to both sides of what used to be the Iron Curtain. We're now rapidly approaching a time when very few members of Congress or the executive branch will have any experience directly with war. Every U.S. president from Harry Truman to George Herbert Walker Bush, whom we were discussing off the air, served in the military. Truman, Bush, and also Kennedy, and as far as we're concerned, Eisenhower, were all combat veterans. Starting with Clinton, I think there is a detectable lack of insight, lack of skill, and sort of casual approach to military affairs that can hurt us and has hurt us.
One of the things that we have not mentioned is how our policy in Syria is linked to U.S. energy policy, and that seems like an underrated subtext to this.
I'm very glad you asked that question, as military veteran Richard Nixon used to like to say. As we discussed, has a weak economy. They're very powerful in energy. Since the Berlin Wall and the Soviet Union fell, there have been regular predictions that their economy is about to collapse. They have a very effective black market, a very effective old-time mafia and collection of mafias, but they also have oil, which has been their ace in the hole. We are developing tremendous new petroleum and related resources thanks to fracking. And in thinking strategically, which we all hope our leaders are, this gives us tremendous leverage in the world.
This is the notion that taking action in Syria doesn't necessarily do anything to ensure the security of our energy supply.
It's not related. Well, Syria, of course, is not a major oil producer, but if the region goes up in flames and our Saudi friends are very active in trying to manipulate the situation in Syria, another point not often discussed but important, we were haunted. We were really worried through the 70s and haunted until recently by the fact that we're dependent on overseas oil. Our politicians obsessively talked about that, especially when running for the White House. They don't talk about it much anymore because we're now a net exporter in gasoline. We soon will be a net exporter in oil generally, which we were until about 1960. This is a huge strategic change and means that we don't have to be as concerned about anyone in that region as we used to be.
It's all interesting food for thought, and I'm sure this is not the last we will talk about it.
Absolutely not. No, it's really important to focus on this.
Art Sear, thanks so much.
Thank you, Mitch.
Art Sear is the Claussen Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business and Director of the Claussen Center for World Business at Carthage College in Kenosha, and he's our foreign policy contributor. Keep listening after a break. Why a lack of sleep might have a significant impact on our bottom line, or at least our waistline. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio.